Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us on the Cleveland Public Library's Sports Archive Show. Our guest today is Bob Roberts, known as the Railbird. Bob has covered horse racing here in Cleveland for the Plain Dealer and the Press and several other papers. You'll tell us about that in
yes.
a minute. Bob, welcome to the Cleveland Public Library. And you've got, this is, by the way, is May 27th, 2015. And we are going to talk about the history of horse racing here in the Cleveland area.
And it's got a great history to it,
At one time, there were, I think Ohio had more racetracks than almost any other state in the Union.
I can believe that. Between Thoroughbred and Harness, there's over 100. Over 100.
Really?
If you count the county fairs, because there are 88 counties, all at one time all 88 had a 3 or 4 day county fair harness meet. So you are over 100.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. Okay. Let's go. We have many funny stories about some of the great racetrack characters. But let's first of all, cover some of the historical aspects, the dry material.
Right.
I can remember Junior O'Malley referencing a racetrack called Bainbridge on the east side of Cleveland.
Right. There was, as far as I can tell, there was Bainbridge, there was Maple Heights, there was Cranwood, Randall, Thistledown, and Ascot, and I may have missed one somewhere.
Ascot was on Route 8 near Akron.
Cuyahoga Falls. They would start the season. They would start the season every year in like March or April at Ascot Park.
But each of these racetracks only had, what, a two-month meet or something?
44 days was the law.
Really?
And then they expanded it to 50, and then now almost anything goes
In fact, at one time, weren't like Randall and Thistledown across the street from each other out there on Emory Road?
Directly across the street from each other. That's where the Randall Park Mall was, Park. Interesting thing was, the guy that owned Randall Park, his name was Saul Silberman.
Yes.
He also owned Tropical Park in Coral Gables, Florida.
Yes.
So if you didn't race at Randall in the summer, you might not have got stalls at Tropical Park in the winter.
Really?
So that 44 days was some of the greatest racing in the country.
Really?
In fact, to this day, Bill Hartack, who has won as many Kentucky Derbies as Eddie Arcaro.
Call me Bill, not Willie.
Right. They've won five each. They're the most by anybody. He, to this day, he holds the record for the most wins at the Randall Park meeting.
Bill Hartack.
In 1953, he won 86 races. That record stands today.
Wow.
Right. By the way, I can tell you an interesting Hartack story. I called him once, and as you said, he did not like the media at all. I left my home phone number. He called back to tell me he wouldn't talk to me.
No, really?
Honest to God.
Oh, that's good.
I can hear the poison coming out of his pores about
brother.
Because he thought he never got the credit for winning as many Kentucky Derbies as Eddie Arcaro.
Well, and Hartack won what, five?
Five. Each won five, right. But he still holds that record from 1953. It's over 62 years old.
Is that still the record?
Yeah, they run, even though Ed DeBartolo, who owned the 49ers, the DeBartolo family, he bought Ascot. He bought Cranwood, he bought Randall, and he owned Thistle. So all four 50-day meets were consolidated at Thistledown. So there is a Randall Park meet every year.
Right,
that record
that.
Still stands. Hartack's record still stands. It was 86 winners in 44 days.
By the way, Silberman was once a minor shareholder in the Cleveland Browns. Commissioner Burt Bell came into Cleveland one time and told the other Browns owners, you have to get rid of Saul Silberman because he was betting on pro football and betting on the Browns. And Paul Brown thought that this was just a real interested minor shareholder, said he would call me every week and ask, how's the team doing? Is everybody healthy? And about injuries. Mm. And Paul Brown thought, that was so nice of him.
Had a betting machine in his office at the track.
He did.
Oh, yeah. He bet with both hands. Oh, yeah. Interesting thing I found on Randall Park. It was sold in 1946 for $180,000, resold in 1950 for $950,000, sold in 1956 for $3.6 million, sold in 1960 from Silberman to DeBartolo for $4.2 million, and then, so that's it. In 14 years, it went from $180,000 to $4.2 million in value.
In 14 years?
Yes.
Because, was it because of the real estate was escalating? Or
and
the
racing was pretty popular, too.
Okay.
And the racetrack would get $20,000, $30,000 on weekends in Cleveland. Cleveland really supported horse racing big time for many, many years. And some great bettors, too. Some great bettors in Cleveland. They had a national bet called the Breeders' Cup Pick 7. For like the first 3 or 4 years, it was hit by guys from Cleveland.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, you bet into this national pool. Yeah. Cleveland always took a piece of it back.
Really?
There was one bettor in Cleveland who was always down on his luck. He put together a syndicate and he hit it. And people would say, and I'm going to make up a different name. Yeah. Hey, did you hear that Bill Smith had the pick 7 mm-hmm. for $1.4 million? They would say, yeah, one more and he might be even. Yeah. Because those winners, they come and they go with these guys.
Oh. So anyway, now we are down to one racetrack. But you don't hear people talking horse racing. And that, now let's talk about the history of gambling here. There was a time back in the old days when nobody bet pro football.
No.
College football was tough to bet on because they didn't have a point spread. They didn't invent the point spread. Some professor at University of Chicago devised the point spread in the late 40s. Hmm. And so then you would have to bet a game. And like Notre Dame one time played Creighton, and Notre Dame was a 30-1 favorite.
Odds,
points. Odds, right. Then you can every game becomes even when you make when they apply the point spread to it. But back then, horse racing was the thing to bet on.
Right. The lottery took a lot of the steam out of it.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you know this. The very first $1 million lottery drawing was tied to a horse race at Thistledown.
Really?
It's called the Ohio Lottery Stakes. They got it down to 10 people. They put a little stage right near the finish line with 10 chairs, and they had a blind draw, and all 10 of them got a horse, and they're off, and whosoever horse won got the $1 million. It was won by an Indian.
An American Indian with a red dot on the forehead?
No, an Indian, American-bred Indian. Oh. And I remember, you know, the guys, the Cleveland Press guys had to hang around longer than the PD guys because they had a second-day angle on a story. Uh-huh. Jim Dudas from the Cleveland Press hung around with this Indian guy who won.
Really?
You know where they went to celebrate?
No.
At McDonald's.
No!
And that was his lead in the paper, yeah. Right. Gee. You know, you can look it up. It's true. Whoa. So, yeah, that took a little bit of the steam out of racing. But now you can bet on your phone. You can watch the races on your phone. You can bet on your computer. So even though it's becoming more of a TV studio sport now, a lot of money's being bet, but people aren't going to the racetrack to bet it.
Yeah, now there is, of course, no admission to the racetracks. They abandoned that, 20 years ago?
You remember the state pass?
Yes.
The state pass would get two people in for free at the racetrack, and they were passed out by legislators. Yes. They would have them all. And if you were in a hurry to get to the racetrack to bet the Daily Double, pay to get in because the long line was the pass line.
Really?
You would miss betting the double if you were waiting to get in with your state pass.
And they also sent these passes to all the media people,
right?
The newspaper guys, not just the sports writers, but the guys who cover the city streets and all that. And we would have people standing in line, can I have your pass?
That's right.
Because we didn't really need a pass to get in. We could just go out there anyway.
But it was good for two. Can I come in with you? Can I go in with you?
Okay.
He would say, right.
So I would always give mine to this bartender at the theatrical. Did you know Nino Rinocello?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Nino had somebody who wanted my pass. So I would give Nino my pass. And then I would drink free at the theatrical. Always. Years.
It was a good trade-off.
Yes.
Yeah, right. But that was they finally abolished those things because it was driving everybody crazy, those state passes. And then they made it admission
free. But you know what? It was difficult to justify charging the $2 or $3 or $4 to get into the racetrack when they were going to take you pay to give them back more money inside.
Right. That's exactly right. And then, you know, the other thing they thought would help racing was they legalized racing on Sundays in the mid-70s. It's been good. It's better than a Tuesday, but it's never been what they thought it would be. It didn't, double the crowds from Saturday.
Yeah.
Saturday's still the best day. There is some talk, it happened this year at the Preakness, that they thought about maybe running the Preakness on a Sunday.
I saw that.
But you know what? They like to run, 15 races that day. Yeah, go ahead. Run the first race at 10:30 on a Sunday morning. See who's there.
When all the gamblers are in church.
Exactly. That's not going to happen. And then in the 80s, they invented simulcasting, where you can go to Thistledown and bet on a race at New York or in Chicago. Uh-huh. So you can go out there now and bet 20, 30 tracks. Guys are out there betting on races from Australia, Hong Kong, whatever you want, you can bet.
Now, of course, Thistledown has changed so much since they put in the slot machines. This is only a couple years ago, like 2013 or so,
yes.
All the slot machines went in.
Yes.
So I went out to bet a year ago to bet on the Derby. Went out to buy my tickets on a Saturday morning. And I went, and I'm looking around. I couldn't find a mutual clerk. Finally, I had to ask one of the security people, where do you go to bet a horse? Oh, you got to go up the escalator and up the second floor or third floor, whatever it is. Then you can look around, try to find a mutual clerk.
Yeah, they're becoming
The main line is all slot machines now.
All the horse bettors have been pushed upstairs to the second fan level, which is the fourth floor on the elevator, or out on the apron out front, yes. And the clerks are becoming like dinosaurs.
Yes.
You know, in the old days, they'd ring that bell and they'd leave the gate and everybody was focused on the race.
Uh-huh.
But now you could be in line to bet the first at Thistledown and the guy behind you wants to bet the fourth at Pimlico and I want to bet the second at Santa Anita. So everybody's in line for a different reason now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now I recall when Junior O'Malley, a character that we'll probably talk about a little later in this conversation, Junior at the end of his life was given the job as Goodwill Ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
They got him a green blazer, and they gave him a little stand on the main line.
I remember. But
he was the information man and the Goodwill Ambassador. And so, but of course, that just gave him enough money to continue to bet. He gave it all back.
Of course.
And so one day he's in line to make his bet, and there's somebody in front of him fumbling around didn't know too much about how to do it. And the Junior's looking at the clock, and he's snapping his fingers. Hey, let's go, buddy, let's go. And the guy finally turns around him and says, hey, who do you think you are? He said, I am the Goodwill Ambassador.
He was obviously one of the main. I put a list of the characters, the main players. Number one would probably be DeBartolo, Ed DeBartolo, the late Ed DeBartolo, because he bought Thistledown and then he bought all the other tracks around and consolidated in one place. Do you remember this?
By the way, that was so efficient, wasn't it, to have all of these different racetracks, plants, and equipment for 44 days?
Right. People like the idea of moving around. It was, and by the way, racing services are different. Maybe your horse didn't like the dirt at Thistledown. Oh. He might like it at Randall. It's deeper or it's not as deep. Or Ascot, different formation of the track.
Oh.
But he probably changed it. But I remember one day, the best, he bought the 49ers. The DeBartolo family bought the 49ers. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's because they're from Youngstown. They didn't have a real feel for Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
The start of the day, the guy went out there, the maintenance guy, to put up the United States flag, and he ran up the 49ers flag. And they booed the fans of Thistledown until they took that flag down.
Really?
And they never put it up again. I think they took it to Boardman and put it out in front of the DeBartolo offices. But I never forgot that they miscalculated how much Clevelanders love the Browns. And that 49er pennant came down real fast.
Whoa.
Right. How about Mike Mackey? Remember Mike Mackey,
sure,
the general
Mike
manager?
Mackey, yeah.
He had like two or three different lives in Cleveland as a general manager. He went away, ran another track, came back. But the best thing I didn't know about this was he had very poor vision. Nobody ever wanted to be in the car with him when he was driving.
Really?
But his great line was, they're sitting around talking one day, he says, you know when I like to drive the most? They said, no, Mike, when? When it's a blizzard, he says, because then I'm even with everybody else. You think about that one. We're all even, man. Yeah, he was something. What about, got to talk a little bit about the two great newspaper handicappers, George Lewis of the Plain Dealer and Izzy Newborn from the Cleveland Press. They sat next to each other for decades in that press box. George loved to bet favorites. Izzy liked to play long shots. George would have the winner of the first race. He'd pay $5.40. Izzy wouldn't have it. Izzy'd pick the winner of the second race. He'd pay $18. And he would say, well, I'm ahead. And George would say, no, you're not ahead. We're tied. We each have a winner. So they fought tooth and nail for decades. So when I first came around in the late 60s, I sat between them. And Izzy would give you anything you wanted to know. He'd help you and learn the game. George wouldn't tell you anything because he was afraid you might use it to beat him.
Yes. In fact, they didn't even speak much to each other, did they?
Very little. And when Izzy died, and I eventually became the handicapper at the press, I told everybody in the press box, the first time we kept track of winners, each other's winners. There'd be a box in the paper the next day. Lewis has five bagger.
Yes,
you know.
Yes.
I said, when I beat this guy for the very first time, I'm going to go out, I'm going to leave the track and get pizza for everybody. So I finally, like the last day of a 50-day meet, took like the fourth race of the day to finally close him out, and I went down the street to Augie's Pizza, got a couple of eight cuts, and I brought him back, and I gave everybody pizza. I says, George, would you like a piece? And he knew what that pizza represented. He wouldn't touch that pizza.
Oh.
But they were great handicappers. Yeah. They had a mind, both of them. Oh,
it's well, incredible. Now, for Lewis, his job was a little tougher because he had to keep his own records of the horses.
There was no advanced racing form for anybody. We all kept our own form on 3x5 cards, carrying them around in a suitcase. I remember once I had the suitcase. I was going to my mother-in-law's for dinner, and I come in the house, and the latch broke, and all those cards tumbled down the basement steps. I was there for hours re-alphabetizing them. It's like a death in the family. Now, there was another great press box character we got to remember. Mel Owens. You remember Mel Owens?
He would run to make the bets for you.
He got us our forms, our programs, the lunch tray, and there was no self-betting machine in the press box. He, like you said, he ran our bets. It kept him young. But here was the scam. He got to keep the change. If you bet 2-1 on a horse and it paid $8.80, you got $8. He loved it when little old ladies came out on Ohio Derby Day and bet $2 to show on a horse, and it paid $2.80. They got their $2 back. He got the 80 cents. But there was another handicapper named Chuck Scarvelli from the Daily Racing Form. Chuck loved the bet and didn't do all that good all the time. So one day he came to me, he says, I got a dollar left. He says, I love a horse in the next race. Give me a dollar, we'll go partners. So I says, here, Chuck, here's a dollar. Mel, go bet us 2-1 on a 7-horse, Chuck told him. So he goes and bets it, and the horse wins and pays $15. Let me tell how sharp Mel was. He came in the room and says, you each got 7.
Really?
Yeah, no, he was great. He knew we were partners, so he broke it down. You each got 7. I'm taking a dollar. You know what? Here's a reason to exercise in life. That running down to make the bets every race kept him young. When they finally put in a self-betting machine, you'd look up there and he'd be sitting there, falling asleep.
Really?
Within 2 years of that self-betting machine, dead.
Wow.
Heart attack.
Wasted away.
Yes, because he wasn't getting up every race to go make bets. So it did him in.
Okay. That one time the Ohio Derby was a big, big race.
Yes, it was a...
Tell us about Black Gold, would you?
Yeah, in racing, they grade races, grade 1, grade 2, grade 3. The Ohio Derby was never a 1, but it was a 2 for many, many years. It was a big race. You'd run to the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness, and if you didn't want to go to the Belmont, you probably came to Ohio for the Ohio Derby because it was always in June, a week after the Belmont. Guy says, I'm not going to go run a mile and a half. Let's go to Cleveland and run a mile and an eighth. But the greatest winner of the Ohio Derby was a horse named Black Gold, 1924. He's the only Ohio Derby winner to win the Kentucky Derby. And you talk about how we baby athletes. He won the Kentucky Derby on May. I'm trying to get my papers here. He won the Kentucky Derby on May 17th.
It was not the first Saturday
not
in May.
Not then, no.
Then.
He won the Ohio Derby on May 24th.
A week later.
And I found a clipping from the racing form from 1924. They worked them a mile the day before the Ohio Derby.
No.
But what makes this a great story was there was a mare named You See It, U-S-E-E-I-T, all pushed together, owned and trained by a guy named R.M. Hoots from Oklahoma, Indian. He was an Indian, American Indian.
Cherokee.
Could have been. Or Osage? Osage?
Osage? Okay.
Yeah, I think he was Osage, like I know Indian tribes. Anyways, he loved this mare, and she won over 30 races, but he put her in a claiming race at Caliente in Mexico, right over the border from San Diego, and somebody claimed it. In other words, claiming races is you figure out what your horse is worth, and you risk losing it for that claiming price. Well, he put her in there, thinking nobody would take her, and somebody took her. He refused to give the mare up. He and the horse were banned from the turf for life.
Really? Both countries, Mexico and the United States?
Yes, right, because they was the same racing, covered both racing back in those days. He took her home and bred her, and the foal was Black Gold.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a great story. Yeah. Black Gold. And Black Gold's now in the Hall of Fame. National Racing Hall of Fame up at the Saratoga Springs. So that is the greatest ever Ohio Derby winner is Black Gold.
Well, okay. On May 17th, wins the Kentucky Derby. 7 days later, 14, wins the Ohio 17th, Derby.
17th. May 17th in Louisville. Came to Cleveland a week later.
Was that?
By railroad car.
Typical back then? Of
they ran them much, much more than they race them now. I mean, they really baby these horses. Now, I guess the average Kentucky Derby horse has like 8 starts in its life. Like 30 years ago, they ran 25, 35 times for their career. And they've just cut back on them so much. But I found a clipping from the racing form from 1924, Black Gold's Third Derby. I like this paragraph. The movie men were on hand in large numbers and clicked their machines on the great Black Gold as he galloped through the stretch, warming up for the race. The remaining 3 starters were led from the paddock but had no chance to win because he just won in a romp.
Wow.
Yeah. So Black Gold would have been your best Ohio Derby winner. There's been some good ones over the years, but he is the most accomplished at all. You know, talking about angles, there was a horse named Believe It who ran behind Ali Dar and Affirm when they had the Great Triple Crown battle. They brought him to Cleveland for the Ohio Derby, and someone said he was a little ouchy. So a lot of people shipped in their horses to try to beat him because it was a $300,000 race where some guys came up from Kentucky, and their horse went off at 100-1. And they won the race. Now, they always have those people up in the lounge afterwards. They have a drink, a victory drink.
Yes.
Those guys got pretty well lit up. And I'm with the Cleveland Press in those days, so I'm hanging around looking for a different angle. The PD guy's gone already, writing his story. I talked to these people. I found out that they
By
made...
By the way, that wasn't me working for the plane dealer.
No,
that day,
I don't think so. We'll lay it on somebody else. No. They made more money betting than they did in the purse.
Really?
Yeah, they took out over 100,000 just in betting on it.
The horse was 100-1
right,
shot?
Right. Exactly. Right. He paid $203.20 for a $2 bet. His name was Special Honor. And there were 2 owners, and one didn't want to go, so he stayed back in Kentucky and pouted, and the other owner came with the trainer, and they bet. So the other guy got half the purse. He got, 90,000 or something, but these guys made over 100,000 betting. Gee. So, yeah, that was a great one.
Well, now, if they bet that heavily, they were winning back their own money.
They said there was something like 1,300, 100 with those odds. It was like $1,300 bet on them, and they had 1,000 of it themselves. Yeah, so that's how they made the big score, Yeah, there's been some interesting stuff there. The best jockey probably ever come out of Thistledown is Tony Rini.
Tony Rini, okay. Who was in the Greater Cleveland Sports Hall of Fame
from Parma? We put him in a couple years ago. That's exactly right. Yeah. He was the best, most accomplished. He rode in several. He never won a Kentucky Derby, but he rode in several. He won an Ohio Derby 1 year, but he got hurt bad in a riding accident at Oaklawn Park in Arkansas, where the arm was totally dead. And they says we should take that arm.
Wow.
He says you can't take my arm. To this day, he's a trainer now at Thistledown, but he never gave up. He's got it strapped to his side, really? But he will not give up that arm. And you should see him play golf with one
really?
Hand. Unbelievable. He was just a great, great, great athlete. Yeah. So he's to this day, he's still out there.
Did he get his arm, by the way, stepped on by a horse? Or the horse fell on his arm?
Yes. It was a morning training accident at Hot Springs, Oaklawn Park at Hot Springs, Arkansas. Yeah. But he's a very accomplished trainer now, too. He's quite the character because he was so beat up. I don't remember the bio we had in the program for the Hall of Fame. That they were afraid they were going to strap him in the bed because they figured he might try to kill himself.
Wow.
And he told him, he says, look, if you find me dead in this bed tomorrow, I didn't do it. Because he didn't want to go anywhere. Right. Right.
Okay, let me tell you just a quickie story about Oaklawn and Edward DeBartolo. I get a call from Junior O'Malley, who was here in town. Junior, we're talking about, 1974 maybe. This is New Year's Day of 1974, I'm going to say. And Junior said, I just got a call from a trainer, a Cleveland guy, who happens to be in Oaklawn right now, and he says he got a report that Edward DeBartolo died. Hmm. And I said, what? That's big news. But anyway, I had to track it down. Well, we're talking about New Year's Day. I didn't have DeBartolo's home phone number.
Hmm.
How do we find him? Of course, the Paul Paul, who was the
Paul Wilcox.
Paul Wilcox, the PR guy for Thistledown. He was, of course, gone. The track was closed all winter. Nobody at DeBartolo Industries is available on New Year's Day. So I know how to handle this. I was at the plane dealer early evening, and I went to the phone room and got the yellow pages for Youngstown and looked up funeral homes. There are two Italian funeral homes in Youngstown. I called them both. And I said, they answered the phone, and I said, I identified myself from the plane dealer. And I said, do you have Mr. DeBartolo? They said, well, no, we don't. Oh, I said, well, okay, well, thank you. So then I called the other one, same thing, identified myself. Do you have Mr. DeBartolo? No, we don't. Hey, problem solved. He's still alive because one of the funeral homes would have him. However, I didn't go one step further and think, what's their reaction? They both now think that he's dead and the other guy has him. And they get on the phone, buzz, buzz, buzz.
Right.
Before the night was over, this news traveled from Boston to San Francisco. The next day, it's January 2nd, and I come to work at the plane dealer, and Hal Leibovitz said, what went on last night? Edward Bartolo's been on the phone all day. He's going to call you back in a couple of minutes. So, okay. And he said, I explained to him exactly what happened, and he said, well, you know, my business is all based on my name. My name is on all of our mortgages, all of our loans, all of our banking stuff is my name. If anything happens to me, my company is in turmoil. And so he said, from coast to coast, the banks were going crazy. Mm. So after that, he gave me his, always made sure I had his home phone number. One time he returned my call from his plane flying from Florida back to Cleveland. He was in negotiations to buy a racetrack in around Tampa Bay Downs.
Yes.
Yeah. And so he returned my call from 30,000 feet over North Carolina on his way back.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
He was something special, that's for sure. He loved the game. The place was better when he owned it. You know, he had a specially made, like it was called a helioplane. This thing was like half helicopter, half airplane. He could land it in the infield at Thistledown. You remember?
I remember he would land a Piper Cub there on the.
That infield. Because that thing would take off in a New York second. Mm-hmm. That's how he could get in and out of there.
Really?
Yes, because other people would see it down there and try to land, and they couldn't get that plane out of there ever again, and they barely were able to land because it was a specially made plane for that confined area. Yeah, I'm sure he had a jet too to get out because he ended up buying Louisiana Downs. That was his other racetrack out in Louisiana.
Then didn't he also own Remington?
Yes.
And at one time,
exactly.
He owned three racetracks.
Right.
Louisiana Downs, Remington, and what was the other one, here or another one now?
Louisiana Downs, well, yeah, Cleveland, Louisiana.
But, I mean, he had three of them. If you win their big derby race, you've got $1 million bonus.
Super Derby at Louisiana Downs, the Remington Park Derby, and the Ohio Derby. Those three, exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, but he really he loved coming out to the track and bet. He didn't hang around for – I mean, he'd come in, have lunch, bet a few races, and get out of there. Mm-hmm. Randall Park used to always have a bunch of celebrities over there because remember Music Carnival?
Sure.
The tent that was where some of the barns are at Thistledown now. All those big names would come over and bet. Boy, I remember one day Mickey Rooney was in town.
No kidding.
And he must have had like his assistant, and the assistant was making the bets. Rooney would just sit there at the track. And the guy bet the wrong numbers. Man, Mickey Rooney gave this guy a tongue lashing like there was no. But I remember one Belmont Stakes. Mickey Rooney was there for the draw for the Belmont,
and in New York.
Yes, and he gets up and says, "You know what paying alimony is like?" Because how many times was he married?
About seven times.
He says, "Paying alimony is like putting gas in another guy's car." That was great. Oh, yeah. And another, when Seattle Slough won the Belmont, the most embarrassing moment I ever was at a racetrack. Seattle Slough was owned by Karen and Mickey Taylor. She was a former airline stewardess. And she was at the head table. Uh-huh. And this is when CBS was broadcasting the Belmont. And Phyllis George, beautiful, Miss America, right? She was there. And the track announcer was Chick Anderson, and he was introducing everyone. Real smooth, southern gentleman, buttery voice. And he gets over, he introduces Phyllis George first, and then he gets ready to introduce Karen Taylor. Goes, and a woman almost as pretty as Phyllis George, and everybody in the room just about died. It came out of his mouth. I don't know how he recovered. I was looking at the rug. I couldn't stand it myself. Oh, I'll never forget that. Yeah.
Wow.
Mickey Rooney's line was better, obviously.
Now, Chick Hearn, wasn't he also the...
this was
the
Chick Anderson.
Oh, Chick Anderson.
Chick,
okay.
You're thinking of the guy that did the Lakers.
The Lakers games,
right,
yes.
Right, right. Chick Anderson did Belmont, and he also did Churchill Downs. He was the one that says, Secretariat's moving like a great machine when he won the Belmont by 31 lengths. Oh, yeah. That was good stuff. And Woody Stevens, one of the all-time great trainers, loved coming to Cleveland for the Ohio Derby. He'd come almost every year with a horse. He liked coming here. They took care of him, and he enjoyed coming here. There was a guy that a trainer named Art Bill Donovan. He had a horse named Lost Code, and he needed this horse to win because he had two sons that were driving him crazy. And I remember I wrote about a column about him. I found the clipping. He goes, "These boys, Pat and Mike, his sons, we're in 11 major automobile wrecks in 3 years.
No.
I don't know how they are still living," said Donovan. "Pat called me one night and said, 'Dad, I dented the car.' I asked him where, and he said, 'On the roof.' Turns out he flipped it over twice. I went to the junkyard the next day, and there wasn't a part of that car that was more than 8 inches tall." His horse won the Derby. He needed the money to pay for car insurance for his kids because they were his assistant trainers and grooms. Oh, yeah. The great Bill Shoemaker came to Thistledown. You remember? He was on a farewell tour in 1989, and Thistledown had him. They probably gave him $10,000-$20,000, and he come in and rode a couple horses. So we got to see the great Bill Shoemaker, too. One of the all-time horrible moments but funny at the same time was they started full card simulcasting, and there's a track in Cincinnati called River Downs.
Yes.
And they did something called the 7-7. They would run 7 races at each track. Thistledown would be on even numbered days on the calendar. We were 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, and 14. And River Downs was 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, and 13. We rotated. If you had the Daily Double, you needed the first in Cleveland and the second in River Downs. So they run the first, fourth at Thistle, and I'm back handicapping the next day, and now it's time for a River Downs race. And I hear this roar from downstairs at Thistledown. I go, well, must be a fight or something. So I go back working, and I hear the roar again. I go, I got to go see what this is. So I go downstairs. I go, what's going on? The guy goes, look at the odds board. They forgot to lock the betting windows. For 7 minutes, people were still betting on the race that had been run at River Downs. They put like they must have put 20 or 30 mutual clerks on trial.
Oh.
We never found out who was supposed to lock the machines.
Oh.
Was it the mutual manager or was it one of the guys up on the 7th floor where the judges are? We never found out, but I remember covering those trials. Those clerks were saying, hey, my customers, they wanted to make a bet. I just gave them what they wanted. I don't think there were any customers. They just leaned on a machine and saw that it was still open and just start punching.
Wow.
Just start punching. One clerk who wasn't working that day told me, he says, if I'd have been working that day, that thing would have run out of paper before I'd have stopped hitting the buttons. I think the worst thing, they were probably afraid to cash the tickets. They had those winning tickets, but they figured if they cash them, the bells are going to go off. So most of them never cashed the tickets, unless they cashed them real soon. And some of them probably had to give the money back.
There's something about gambling and the racing industry that invites chicanery.
Well, yes, and this is undocumented, but this is the – talk about chicanery. This is chicanery times God knows what. There was a jock out there that rarely won. Maybe, you know, he'd be like one of those 2-for-80 guys, right? He had to make his money being a groom in the morning or hot walking horses or what exercising horses. He was going to get married. So the jock says, all right, you're getting married Saturday? Yeah. You got 1 mount that day, right? Yes, I do. It's on a horse that always went to the front but got tired turning for home. So they said, all right, here's the deal. We're going to watch you open up that big lead, and we're going to pretend like we're trying to catch you, but we're not going to catch you today. This is your day. Here's your honeymoon money. So just stay low on that horse and get the money. They're off. He has the big lead. They turn for home. He's got an 8-length lead. It's starting to shrink, but no one's supposed to come and get him, right? All of a sudden, nearing the wire, here comes some guy on the far outside, nails him right on the wire. that little creep figured that nobody else is trying. Uh-huh. This is going to be easy pickings for me. He beat the guy on his wedding day.
Jeez.
Yeah. I don't know if they beat the tar out of him or what, but supposedly that happened at Thistledown.
Jeez.
Yeah. Great story. Hey, there's one jockey out there that we should mention because he's part of history. Jeff Radosevich. He's now a retired trainer. Now he's a retired jockey, now a trainer. He is the only horseman in the history of Thistledown to be champion jockey and then turn around and be champion trainer. He was like the leading rider in in the 80s or 90s, and now the last 3 or 4 years he's been the leading trainer out there. It's never been done before. Mediocre jockey became a good trainer or vice versa, but he's the only one that's won both kind of titles. So he's pretty unique.
We want to go back to Junior O'Malley.
Oh, yes.
The stories about him are just limitless.
Yeah, and you and Junior helped race because you brought Junior down the Channel 8, and he would give a tip every morning,
yes,
correct?
Yes,
right.
But prior to that, I started writing about Junior back in the late 60s at the Plain Dealer.
Oh, I know that.
He was my mentor. He took me out to Thistledown for the first time, and he marked my program. This is the late 60s. And picked all every 10 races, this is what you should bet on. This horse is going to win. At the end of the day, not only did he not have a winner, but none of his selections even finished in the money, not in the top three. And Junior said, do you know how hard that is?
I don't know. I handicapped horses in the paper for 4 years. Sometimes it doesn't seem like it's that hard. But the greatest story, you got your stories, I got mine. Yeah. We have to tell the one about when he was he's a mutual clerk. His job is to sell tickets to customers, and they have a wooden box with the little panels, and the 20s go here, the 50s go here. And they were allowed to bet because in those days, we think like 50% of the handle came from the barn area. The bets came from the barn area. Another 15 to 20% came from the clerks, so the public was good for 30 or 40%. So the clerks were allowed to bet. But with your own money, please. Well, Junior would start with the 20 or a 50, and then he'd be broke by the sixth race, and he would do what they call betting out of the box. He'd reach in like the kid in the candy store and use the track's money. And if the horses he bet on didn't win, at the end of the day, he was short.
And so, he would be suspended for a week or a day, and he would be scolded. And
Right, but he'd go to the track anyways and bet just from the other side of the window.
But then he'd be back in good graces in a week.
Right. So the mutual manager says that's enough of that. So those guys used to work the same window every day. So he says to the guy next to Junior, the next time you see him betting out of the box, call me. I'll come running. So it didn't take long. He broke before the day was half over. Somebody whispers a horse in his ear for the eighth race, and he's leaning on that button, punching out tickets, and they're all over the place. And here comes the mutual manager, and he goes, Junior, what did I tell you? They're off. And the mutual manager looks up, and Junior bet all threes. And now he's pulling for the three to get there. So he get the money back for the track.
Right. What did you bet on, Junior? The three horse. come on, three.
Because
it's a lot easier on everybody if Junior wins.
That's exactly right.
Less paperwork.
That's right. And no suspension. Right. The three wins. And Junior sees the mutual manager with all these ticks. He goes to the mutual manager, hey, don't get your money mixed up with my money.
Yeah.
And that was the end. And I'm sure it repeated itself many times.
Yes.
You know, there's a great line about jockeys. Because a lot of bettors always want to blame the jockey, not the horse, right? So the line was, nobody under 5'6" ever answered the phone at the White House and never will.
Ever ran what?
Never answer the phone at the White House because they're not bright enough. A lot of them come out of the backwoods of America. But remember Danny Wyler? He was a very sharp jockey. Sure. He invested his money so he could retire early.
Came out of Cleveland Heights, I believe.
That's right. Yeah, Danny Wyler and Tony Rini and Herbie Clark were probably the best jockeys to come out of Cleveland. Now, Eddie Maple, who rode Secretariat in Secretariat's very last race, was from Carrollton, Ohio, down the road. He was another one. And there was another great jockey named Larry Schneider who rode out of Toledo. So Ohio's had its share of good. And Hartack was from the Pittsburgh, other side of Pittsburgh area.
Oh, he was. Now, let's get back to Eddie Maple briefly. He rode Secretariat in
his last race because I think Ron Turcotte must have.
That was not the Belmont, huh?
His last race. No. That was it, Ronnie Turcotte for the Belmont. Secretariat's last race was the Canadian International Championship at Woodbine in Toronto.
Really?
Yeah, right.
Now, it must have been a big-paying race to get Secretariat
up
there.
Huge purse. There's another guy we should mention. You just triggered my memory, but That was my very first Kentucky Derby was Secretariat as a reporter. Somehow I talked the Willoughby News Herald into sending me to the Kentucky Derby.
So you started at the Willoughby News Herald.
Yes, 1973. That was my very first Derby. And my last one for the PD was Barbaro, a great horse in 2006. But we talk about Junior being a great, great horse story. How about our friend, he's gone now, Off-Track Eddie Calvi.
Yes.
He owned a Cleveland Power Piping Company. And he didn't want too many people to know that he loved the horses, but he loved the horses. He got that nickname, Off-Track Eddie, because he excelled at picking winners when the track was sloppy or muddy. He carried this huge book around that the racing form would put out, like the year-end yearbook. It had every horse and every start in abbreviated form, but it would show the track condition. It might say Monmouth, April 9th, fourth race, finished third, sloppy or fast. So he carried that around with him. He had a horse racing on the circuit in Kentucky named Buddy LaRosa, who just became Secretariat when it rained. This was in the days when you couldn't get internet access and race results and weather reports, so he wanted to know if it was raining at Churchill Downs that day. He called the Louisville Weather Department, said he was from Anderson Amusements. He was going to be moving some rides through town. Should he put the tarp over the Ferris wheel? Guy says, it's pouring here. And you bet Buddy LaRosa.
Oh, geez.
But Eddie's claim to fame was he didn't like to bet at Thistledown that much because it wasn't good enough racing for him. He wanted to bet stakes races and allowance races and grass races. So he flew to wherever their race was for the day to bet and come home. He'd fly to Baltimore for the day, to Pimlico, come home. Laurel, which is near between Washington and Baltimore, come home. Belmont, come home. Florida, come home. I met him 1 year at the Ohio Derby. He come out for one race a year, the Ohio Derby. And he says, hey, kid, you want to come with me to the races? Just bring some bet money. He said, I'd write those tickets off to the company. So I would go with him every so often. But his one claim to fame was the Ohio Derby. He had a winner called Return of a Native. The horse shipped from New Jersey. Back in the 70s, there was the Morning Telegraph. That was the racing form for the East Coast. And then Chicago and Cleveland was the daily racing form. A workout didn't transfer on this horse, a morning workout from the Eastern form to the Chicago form. But he had both editions, and he saw that workout, and he bet the horse. And he watched the race from the roof at Thistledown, and he almost went off the side of the roof because the horse won and paid like $110 for two and broke down two steps past the wire. The jockey had to walk him back to the winner's circle. Couldn't even be on him for the picture. But that's where I met him, and he made a big score that day. You know, Cleveland is definitely where the East ends and the Midwest begins because we're the only city in the country to get both editions of the racing papers. We got the form and the Morning Telegraph.
That's quite a distinction, you know.
Yes, and he had them all. And he would, this is the best, in the wintertime, he would rent a Winnebago and pay one of his employees.
This is Off-Track Eddie.
Yes.
He lived in like Fairview.
Fairview Park, right. He would pay one of his employees to drive that van to Miami Beach, and then he would fly him home.
He had all of these forms.
All the racing forms were in the Winnebago, and that was his library. He would stay at the hotel. He'd park the Winnebago in the hotel parking lot and go out and do his homework. Yes, unbelievable. What a fan of horse racing he was. Taught me to eat soup 12 months a year. So it doesn't matter that it's August. You want a bowl of soup? We're going to have a bowl of soup. And loved to drink Blue Nun wine.
Really?
Always had a bottle of Blue Nun when we went to the track. Go to Hialeah with him. Uh-huh. I'm going tomorrow. I go, okay, Eddie, let's go. It was one of those March days where it was like 55 degrees. You didn't even need a coat to go to Hialeah, to Hopkins Airport. We come home, man, it was snowing sideways. My car was on E. My mother pumping gas. Was like, no coat on. Yeah, I miss him. Oh. He was a great guy. And he studied, remember in the old days, the airlines, you had that book of all the flights? Looked like a little yellow pages. He had that thing memorized.
Gee.
He knew every flight. That's when it was fun to fly. Because if we were leaving at 11 o'clock to go to Baltimore, he'd show up at the gate at 5 minutes to 11. None of this 2 hours, take your shoes off stuff. You know what I mean? Loved the bet. Never bought a horse, but loved the action.
Gee.
Yeah.
Well, this, You've had a glorious lifetime career in racing.
I wanted, if I should have brought this with me, in my Willowick Junior High Lancer newspaper, where I was sports editor, the last edition, the back page had everybody what they were going to be when they grew up, what you wanted to be. Mine said, world's greatest handicapper.
Really?
Honest to God. I may not have been the greatest, but I'm a handicapper. I've had a great life being at the racetrack.
Okay. There was a time when you could make bets with bookies.
Oh, yes.
No longer.
No. In the old days, bookmakers would take horses from 12 o'clock to 5, break for dinner, come back and book baseball for like till 6:30, 8 o'clock. And the only reason I know that is a little bit of that went on in my household when I was growing up. So I know a little bit about that. Right, right. But you know what they say about horse bettors? Nobody's ever jumped off the 480 bridge with tomorrow's racing form in their pocket. You always hope. There's always hope if you got the next day's form.
Then there was past posting, and there were no pay phones in racetracks.
Yes, there were. They would lock.
I'm sorry, but
yes,
yeah,
they would
right.
lock.
They would
There'd
lock
be a pay
them.
Phone
yeah.
booth,
yes.
and they would put a lock on the door right. before the yeah. first race.
Yes.
You remember Dunn News downtown?
Sure, I do.
Dunn News was where the racing form was just right down there, a couple doors down from the plane dealer,
yes, that's
next
right.
to the firehouse.
Uh-huh.
That's where you'd go to get the form in the morning.
Right.
It was a guy named Edmund Kuharski. We called him Junior. He'd go to the depot, the Greyhound depot, and bring the forms back. Well, I'm in there one day getting a form.
Now, they would come in on a Greyhound bus?
Yes, come in on a bus.
And the form in Cleveland was printed where?
Chicago. And then we got the ones from the East Coast, too, because we got both in Cleveland. We got both because of Waterford Park, which is now called Mountaineer Gaming. That was called Waterford Park in the old days. Uh-huh. That was considered East Coast. So for Clevelanders to bet, it was only a couple-hour drive to Mountaineer or Waterford. That's why we got both editions of the form. But I'm in there one day buying a form, and some guy recognizes me. He goes, and I remember I had the bankroll in the paper. I'd bet imaginary bets. Well, I was having a bad year. I was probably down to $300 in a couple of months. And this guy's giving me, he says, let me tell you what you're doing wrong, he says. And I just politely listened to him, and we both walked out, and his car was parked in front of mine, and he had a 2x4 for a back bumper. He was telling me how to handicap horses. He didn't have a bumper on his car. Past posting. For people who don't know what that means is, there was a sheet put out every day called a scratch sheet, and it would have the post times for each race. The first race goes at 1 o'clock. The second race goes at 1:25. Well, guys would find out where some tracks, for some reason, went early. Maybe the 1:25 went at 1:20 for some reason. Who knows why? Somebody's clock was off or whatever. They would try to call the book. They knew who won. They would call the bookmaker and try to pass post the bookmaker by betting on a race they knew the winner. Well, there were two brothers that were really sharp. They called to pass post the bookmaker. And the guy goes, hey, am I too late to bet the third at the Narragansett, which was in like Rhode Island or Massachusetts? The guy goes, what do you want to bet? Because the bookmaker was sharp, too. He knew who won. He knew they went early. The guy goes, I want to bet the 4 to win. The bookmaker knew that the 3 horse won the race. He goes, all right, I'll take your bet. You want 10 to win on the 4? You got it. The guy goes, the bookmaker goes, is that it? He goes, hey, hang on a minute. My brother wants to bet, too. The brother wants to bet 20 to win on the 3. And the bookmaker's got to take the bet because he took the first. So that's the old double whammy pass poster. Yeah. You had to be very careful. But now everything's on the computer.
And then, of course, you would set up a guy. You would make 2, 3, 4 bets, pass post them that you know are losers. You set them up. Or maybe you just – whatever, but then you about the 4th or 5th time, you've got the winner, and you pat. You say, "Hey, listen, I'm down here at Clifton Beach, and I had to wait for the phone. Can you get this bet down for me?" This guy's always making these bets, and they're always losers. So he set them up, and I know a guy who told me that story.
Oh, sure.
How he did it. Everybody is looking for a scam.
Exactly. It was an art form to those guys.
Yes.
It was cat and mouse game. They played with each other. It was, of course, those days are gone, like you said. So I don't know. We just you can watch it. I went on
a
crew.
So many, Bob, there's so many things to bet anymore. Right. You can not only bet basketball, baseball. You can even bet hockey if you want. Junior O'Malley once bet hockey. Only because that's when he, you know, he took a pledge that he would not bet a horse for a year.
Right.
So he bet football, baseball, and even he was asked, somebody said to his wife, well, does he ever bet hockey? She says, oh, he knows nothing about hockey. He couldn't win anything.
Well, yet. That's a joke. The guy calls and bets 10 NFL games on a Sunday. He loses them all. Calls. He says, is there any NBA games tonight? Guy goes, yeah, there's six. So he bets all six of those. He loses all of those. He calls back on Monday. Yeah. He says, what do we got tonight? The guy says, we got four hockey games. The guy goes, what do I know about hockey? Like you said. Yeah, you're already 0 for 16. Yeah. What do you know about hockey? Hey, you talk about betting on anything. Yes. And anywhere. I went on a cruise last year with my wife.
Yeah.
And we're in Mexico. And I like the horse at Gulfstream. I sat in a little cafe with my iPhone. Made the bet on the phone, and watched the race on the phone from Mexico. So, yeah, the game has changed tremendously. Now there's something new. A website called Derby Wars. It's fantasy betting on horse racing. It's imaginary two-to-win, two-to-place bets, first and second, and you end with 40 other guys who put up like $20 or $30, and like they pay the top three guys, $300 to the winner, $100.50 for second, and you can bet like that now. Oh, it's incredible. Then they got some games that are, you put up 100 or 200, and you're playing for like 5,000. So, yeah, it's really changing. Right. Derby Wars. Fantasy. It's like rotisserie horse racing.
Well, it's like the old night at the races.
Oh.
The fundraiser for the school.
Oh.
The night at the races. Show these old films. Oh, yes.
Right.
Yes.
Which sparks a great story. Remember Andy Beyer from the Washington Post?
Oh, he was a great handicapper.
Yes, very good. Great writer, too. Probably a better writer than a handicapper. But he's in Florida for the winter with his buddies, and they want to bet every race or sporting a pari-mutuel event in Miami for the day. They want to bet all the races at Gulfstream. They want to bet all the races at the Hollywood Dog Track. They want to bet all the games at the Dania High Line. And they want to bet all the harness races at Pompano Park at night. So they dispatch everybody in four different directions, and they bet them all. Now they're going to meet at night at a bar near Pompano that shows the replays. Meet at 11 o'clock when the replay show starts. So they're going over, how we do it? Well, we lost at Gulfstream, and we broke even at Dania, and I think we made a few bucks at the dog track. But now we're going to watch these 10 harness races via videotape. And like we're at the track. So they win the first. They blow the next four or five. They got some long shot in the seventh race. They're turning for home. Some trotter opens up two lengths, and then they're out of their chair. Come on! And a guy at the next table says, he don't get there. He told him he was at the track. He knows the horse gets caught. He took the air out of him that. He don't get there.
Yeah.
There's gambling stories all over the place. Here's one for you. There was a guy from the Westchester paper in New York covering the Derby, and he was tight with the technicians from ABC TV, and they all wanted to bet the Derby. They all wanted the same horse. So he could bet at the press box betting window, which no line, right? And these guys were too busy running cords and electrical wires. So they said, would you bet this 300 for us? We wanted you to bet it on the, you know, for the Derby on the four horse. He goes, sure. So he goes up to the press box. He goes right before the window, right before the first race, because the Derby's going to be later, obviously. He goes, give me 400 to win on the three horse. Well, he bet the first race, not the Derby. The horse won. He picked up like 1,500, put 1,200 in his pocket, and bet their 300 on the horse that they wanted later on the day for the Derby. Even though what, you know, like just fell out of the clouds.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we could go on all day.
And night, right.
And we almost did.
Yes. Well, this is fun. This is, well, there's some, racing's got great stories. You know that. You know that, right.
Well, Bob Roberts, the great handicapper from the Willoughby News Herald.
You name it, I've been there.
Plain Dealer, Press.
And now Youngstown Vindicator covering the new track in Youngstown. Oh, but this is great because my grandkids and my great-grandkids can hear this down the road. This is good stuff.
Well, thanks to everybody for joining us today as we talk to Bob Roberts, one of the great racetrack characters himself.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, Bob.
My pleasure.